wherever you are, wherever you are, and whenever it is, you are catching some Vrain waves coming to you from the banks of the verdant and imperial St. Vrain River in almost always sunny Longmont, Colorado. I'm Becky Peters, and across the table is my co-host who can do more on a landline than the rest of us can do on our smartphones, Ben Kalb. Ben, what's good?
It's all good, Becky. Just doing my best Marigold impression all week. It's been an awesome week, and I'm really excited to keep bringing interviews to help inform, inspire, and connect educators. Last week, we interviewed Dr. Katie Martin, the author of Learner-Centered Innovation, and she was amazingly inspirational. So we encourage you to go check out her interview where we talk about project-based learning and how you can help bring learner-centered innovation to your classroom.
She was fantastic, and we are going to outdo ourselves yet again. For this episode, we're so excited to dive into the largest organ of learning, the human brain. We are lucky to learn tons of brain-based takeaways from one of the authors of the book Neuroteach, Mr. Glenn Whitman. But first...
Hey Siri, what time is it?
It's time to get out of our heads and into the classroom.
I need help! Somebody please help me.
Help me!
Give me something I can use. Let's get out of our heads and into the classroom.
That's right. It's Out of Our Heads Into the Classrooms, the part of the show where we offer tangible tips, actionable advice, and superior strategies that you can use in your classroom tomorrow. Today's topic is the brain, so we're going to stay in our heads a little bit as we give tangible tips and talk about some brain-based research and tips and things we can do because of it.
So settle into my voice because I'm really excited about this content and I'm going to take a minute. Is that cool?
I'm settled.
Okay, awesome. So while we're all trying to get away from memorization for the sake of regurgitation on a multiple choice test, there's no doubt that memory and memorization strategies help us learn and integrate new knowledge. You don't have to want to go search Google every time you need to know something. You wouldn't get anywhere in life. So when there are things that you or your students need to remember, one strategy is a memory palace or a memory journey. This is a technique that memory grandmasters rely on to memorize tens of thousands of digits of pi, and that the best speakers rely on to memorize the flow of their speeches. You can take a memory journey any place you know well, like your house, your classroom, your town, or even your own body. And the idea is that you put the content that you're trying to remember as like an image into a place, like your house, and glue it together with some sort of action. Kevin Horsley is an international grandmaster of memory who started off hating school because of severe dyslexia, interestingly enough. And he says the best way to get your brain engaged is to imagine content and then connect it to something you already know. So for today's episode, I wanted to remember to tell you a few interesting things about cognitive science. So I'm going to walk you through what a memory palace might look like for this journey. So I go up to my front door at my house, and there's an old man with a cane that opens the door for me. That will remind me to tell you about priming, which is the phenomenon where our brains perceive words and objects even if we don't know it. Like if, for example, I had you read a story about anything, and it included the words old, slow, Florida, tired, things like that, you would actually walk down the hall more slowly after reading that story, or be quicker to identify and understand other things about related to being old in age. Then I walk down my hall, and I have to jump over a big chasm that's developed in the hallway. That will remind me to talk to you about spacing, which is an important concept for learning that suggests that things are better encoded into your long-term memory when you space your learning out over time instead of trying to cram it in all at once. After I jump over that chasm, I would walk into my kitchen and I'd see a big brain hiding under my kitchen table because I wanted to remind you to listen to the podcast called Hidden Brain by Shankar Vedantam or read his book, which has a ton of stories and insights about the heuristics that our brain uses to learn and then make meaning of that content. A lot of times without our knowledge, that's why it's called hidden brain. It's amazing how often we dig in our heels for reasons that can be explained more by neuroscience than really by our being right all the time. And there are lots of interesting sources for information like this. So, like, way too many to name. Thinking Fast and Slow, You Are Not So Smart. I'll link some stuff in show notes if you're interested in this sort of thing. Now, you might be saying, that's all fine and good for just memorizing things for a speech, but how does a memory palace help my learning develop? Well, Kevin Horsley reminds us that the more you know, the easier it is to know more. He also says memory is not just about learning content and stuffing it into your brain, that you have to know that content to be able to control it, shape it, and creatively wield it to create the results you want. I love that quote. I'll link his episode of that Science of Success podcast in our show notes. He walks you through another memory journey that you might enjoy and explains the benefit of memory strategies in a lot more depth.
That's fascinating. I knew none of that stuff, and I know our listeners are going to love it because I was just like blown away by it. So I think that's such a cool story that you tell, and stories go into my tangible tip for the week. and that is bring more stories to your class and your content, because the human brain actually craves stories. There's actually a really interesting theory that the reason that your brain has crazy dreams at night when you're sleeping is because your brain has been absorbing facts and data all day and wants to somehow create a narrative from that chaos and all of that data. And so our brain wants story. It looks for it even in the randomness in our dreams. So when we're sitting in a class and we hear a Ferris Bueller style lecture, the only part of our brain that is involved and activated is the language processing center, the part that decodes words, and that's called Broca's area. But when we hear a story, any part of our brain that would light up and activate if we were experiencing that story of ourselves lights up and activates. It's fascinating. So we talk all the time about getting our students to be more empathetic. When you hear a story, your brain acts as if it experienced that story itself. So when you hear a phrase like, "My teeth chattered from biting into the cold, crisp red apple," your brain activates as if you just bit into a crisp red apple right along with me. Or when you hear a phrase like, "I walked the loud, busy school corridor and a sixth grader wearing way too much Axe body spray bumped into me with his shoulder," your motor cortex lights up as if you had been bumped into by a smelly sixth grader. So anytime we can get more stories into our classroom, whether we're telling them or encouraging our students to tell them, it is a good thing. And one of my favorite mantras comes from a video production company called Still Motion, and they say, "Touch the heart to move the mind." And so the more we can teach our students to be awesome storytellers, the more successful they're going to be in life.
Thanks for that, Ben. That was Out of Our Heads and Into the Classroom. And now we're going to move on to our interview. I couldn't be more excited for our guest today. Glenn Whitman is the co-author of NeuroTeach, Brain Science and the Future of Education, and he directs the Center for Transformative Teaching and Learning at St. Andrew's Episcopal School. Glenn is a former Martin Institute for Teaching Excellence fellow and author of other books, and he's also a co-editor of Think Differently and Deeply, which is a national publication, and also a podcast now, so we'll link to that as well.
And I can honestly say, in 10 years of public education, this is the first time I've ever dug into the brain, and I'm a little embarrassed to say that, but I'm happy to have learned from him. And in this episode, we talk about what are some things that we should do differently based on the most current brain research, and then we go over his unconscionable list, and those are things that we should never, ever, ever do again because of the new research.
I think there's only one educational truth that's indisputable, I think. I would say that every day, every kid will bring his or her brain in every class. Now, I can't believe there's anybody who can argue that with me, right? We know they will have this organ of learning with them. Now, whether it's maximized and used at the potential we would like, I would argue is a shared authority, which we write in NeuroTeach, between the teacher and the student. Now, I didn't think like that as an educator growing. You know, when I got in the field, I've been teaching since 1991. So for some of your listeners, that might be old. For some, it might be young. Maybe some people who've been in it for 50 years will call me a rookie. But, you know, I really set out as an educator I wanted to master my content. I wanted to know my content excellently. There's nothing, expert teachers have to know their content. But, you know, I really never even thought until midway through my career, how do kids actually learn? I mean, I really I wasn't exposed to that type of training. I didn't prioritize that type of training. So when our school, the school I'm at now is the St. Andrew's Episcopal School. It's in Potomac, Maryland, just outside of Washington, D.C. In 2007, we asked ourselves this question of, you know, what makes an expert teacher? And that's a great question that every school should ask. And, you know, we did our due diligence. We talked about, you know, technology integration has to be better, project-based learning, multicultural education, you know, data-driven decisions, whatever that really means. I have no idea. But really the aha moment was when we really said, do we actually know enough about the organ of learning and how kids learn? And when we surveyed our faculty initially, our St. Andrew's faculty, and this data holds up to any school we've worked with around the world, private, public, charter. Roughly 20% of our faculty had said they've been exposed to some level of foundational knowledge or training in the learning brain. And that could be through a book. It could be through one of the Learning in the Brain conferences. You know, it could be a conference of another sort. So we thought, whoa, maybe this is the great irony in education, right? We know a kid will have their brain every day. we know it's the organ of learning. I will also say with the heart, but certainly. And we also now know, at least from our school setting, but it also holds up across schools, that teachers actually know very little about this thing. What if we went after that? And so that's what we did. As a school, we decided, and this was a brave moment for us, we said, we're going to try to train 100% of our faculty in mind, brain, education, science. Now, we had no clue how to do that. I've got to be honest with you. We didn't know what was out there. It was the early stages of all of us being inundated by brain-based, brain-directed, you name it. As long as the word had a brain in it, they were trying to sell it to educators. So we said, look, could we make better St. Andrews teachers by training ourselves in the learning brain? And that's what we did. And we jumped into it in 2007. And if you're hired at our school, you get 3 days of training in educational neuroscience. And then every year, our whole community of teachers and school leaders builds upon that initial training through research from, the great universities and great researchers out there, whether it's Denise Pope at Stanford or Dan Willingham at UVA or Rob Coe at the University of Durham in the UK. We scour the world for people who are leaning into this space.
Wow. That is incredible. So what kind of impact have you seen then? I guess that begs the question. If you've been doing it since 2007, what have your teachers responded?
Any kind of decision that you're going to be an all-in model, which is how we approached it, right? We decided we're not just going to have the English department get trained and the other faculty not be trained, because we didn't want kids to go from, let's say, a research-informed teacher in one discipline, but then go to another class where they're still using the abacus and chalk and a blackboard, right? So we really, and we preach this a lot to schools we work with, is, the all-in model, the 100% training model was really an important decision by our school. And I think this would be the biggest, most sustained initiative in our school's history. I mean, a lot of us who are listening to this podcast have been in schools that have initiatives. Initiatives usually last a year. If I can wait out the year, something new will come along and I can hide maybe and that'd be good.
This whole brain thing will go away.
Yeah.
Yeah, right. I agree. Fair enough. So, we said, well, let's train everybody. And we not surprised when we started with our middle school. But, I think our faculty probably, you have at every school the early adopters, the innovators, right? The very small percentage who are going to run with what you teach, and that's great. How do you get to the large majority of your faculty who you can bring along? It's just going to take a little more time and patience and, some cajoling. And then there's obviously that group who wants to close the door and say, hopefully they won't come find me. I think, though, we wanted over a lot of it for our school initially was mission driven. Our mission is to know, inspire each student with exceptional teaching and learning and service. So if you believe that any level of exceptional teaching is defined by knowing more about the brain, then it's a win. And I also think we never lost sight of the idea that who are we doing this for? And we were doing it to try to create more efficient, confident, independent learners, all our kids. We weren't thinking of the weak kids. We weren't thinking of the strong kids or the kids that none of us think about, which is the just fine kid, which we write in the book. And the last thing, which I actually say was a win for this process, was we did not anticipate the enthusiasm our faculty had about working with research. Education can be a very stifling in terms of creativity profession. And the idea that we were challenging faculty to look at research, consider how it fit with their students and their context, really generated some buzz that we were not anticipating would help both attract and retain and even develop our current teachers and as well as the next generation of teachers.
That's fascinating. I'm going to ask you to dig a little bit more in on that, because I've seen on your blog and on your website, one of your webinars or a podcast, I can't remember which one, it says, can you change the culture of a school through research? And I would love to know the answer to that question based on what you just said. I mean, I'm super curious about how we can get research to be more at the center of things. And you're, like you just said, you didn't anticipate the enthusiasm for research. That's amazing. I want to hear more about that.
Well, I mean, I said that earlier on, an irony of education is how little we know about the learning brain. Another irony is we don't intentionally use research enough in the education space to improve the quality of our instruction, right? A lot of great teachers have great instinct. A lot of great teachers out there are artists and designers. They have their canvas is time, they've designed it. unfortunately, a lot of that is stifled because you're handed a script or whatever and said, okay, you have to achieve these clear goals, when I think it is really important to consider whether it's the right goal for that kid or those kids and whatnot like that. I think the issue of the teacher as a researcher, we approached it on three levels. One is what we asked ourselves the question, what research is already out there that's being underutilized by educators that should be informing our practice? We call it ready-made research, right? And there's plenty. I mean, there's, you know, just in the field of memory alone, what we now know about how to teach and coach kids to memorize better, which we know is so important to learning. I mean, the old tried and true was use flashcards, right? And that's still really important. But generally, most kids use flashcards incorrectly, right? They turn them too quickly. Yeah, there's actually studies done on this, right? So there's no struggle, right? Or they get this illusion of being fluent and learned in what's on the flashcard just because they turn them over and they look at the answer. And then when it comes time to the assessment, it's not there. Wonder why. But we also know much more about the spacing effect and active retrieval and dual coding and stuff like that. And during this time of year when we're having this conversation, you know, it's a stressful time of year right now in April for most schools and teachers, right? It's AP exams are coming up. Other state and national assessments are coming up. Final exams are coming up. And, you know, memory is in high demand. And if we, you know, we can teach memory strategies better today because of research. And I think when we went for some of those low-hanging fruits in the field of memory, how to give better feedback, how to do project-based learning better, which, again, you know, kids need to hang their curiosity on knowledge. Knowledge is still critical for project-based learning. Sometimes we forget that. How do we have kids reflect? I think teachers began saying, wow, there's this bucket of research that's sitting there that I haven't really applied to my practice. You know, the next two steps are a little more challenging, right? How do you do sort of what is called action research with the students in front of you? That is a little more challenging, but I think our faculty and faculties we work with around the world have really found it not too onerous, right? You know, what if you had a control group and you tried one strategy with one group and just not with the other, and just in a very fun, playful way saw what happened? That's a fun way to think about the craft of teaching. So I think the ready-made research, the action research, and then the hardest bucket, and again, I'm not too sure sometimes the value, is doing original research studies at your school. They cost a lot. They take a long time. And what we've learned from this is most teachers want to do research that's going to affect the kids in front of them.
Mm-hmm.
And too many times, unfortunately, a good research studies, you know, these random control trials, which are still held up as the gold standard, you know, take place 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 years. And that's 5 years of teach students that you wish you could have been able to help.
Right.
Why not do a little more action research and be trained in that kind of process and help the kids who are in front of you each year?
I love thinking about it as learning from a bucket of research. And one of the great things about your book is that you have really tangible takeaway tips for things that teachers should do and should not do based on that bucket of research. So can we start with the should not do? You have a list called the unconscionable list, things that teachers never, ever, ever should do. Could you go over a couple of those and what the brain research says about why we should never do those things?
Yeah. I mean, I think when we wrote NeuroTeach, one is, unlike a lot of the books in the field, is that we get to write it from a teacher perspective. We actually, Ian and myself, we teach every day still. I mean, I've taught anything from 6th grade to 12th grade. Ian's, I know, taught mostly upper school. So unlike a lot of the resources out there, we definitely bring a different element. So the question is, what are we doing that might be considered detrimental pedagogy, so to speak?
Yeah.
That is just... even though intuitively we might believe it, maybe it's just not good for most kids, right? And, you know, and I think, you know, simple things that jumped out of us, and even the unconscionable list that was in NeuroTeach has sort of grown. I think killers are like labeling students, right? I mean, you know, as soon as you create this idea that this student's lazy or this student doesn't care, one is, I think you're pushing all the responsibility on the student, which I think is not what teaching and learning is about. I also think you're creating a fixed mindset about the student, and that it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy for the kid. And I think labels are really critical to try to avoid. I think the big ones, if I had my druthers in the world, I believe surprise quizzes that count for substantial points are one of the most unfair teaching strategies that I don't think is very defensible out there. And generally, I think they're used to be punitive and to catch kids being bad, right? Now, I do believe formative assessments are really important, right? Low stakes or no stakes. And those can be surprises. I have no problem with that. But when you have that 30-point surprise quiz on the night's reading, I think immediately if you know the science behind the brain, you know a couple of kids, even they might be your best students, will perform poorly because he or she or they will have become frozen in their thinking because of fear, period. So I think that would be one thing that I hope gets thrown out. Wasting the beginning and end of class. The one thing we've noticed a lot when we go visit classes, and we get a great privilege to do that, is, you know, the brain comes to each class, and this is how my thinking has changed, ready for something novel, ready to be inspired, ready to be engaged. And as soon as the first thing you do is take attendance for a couple minutes, go over the administrivia, the homework for tomorrow, before you even have a class today, I mean, that's like, shoot me there. I mean, how am I going to enjoy the rest of this class, right? And I think some of the most creative teaching is, how do you use those first sort of 7 to 10 minutes to engage the kids? And I get it. We still have to take attendance, but we certainly don't need the kids to be still to figure out who's there, right? So, and the same thing also at the end of class. Amazing how many teachers teach to the last second of class, giving new instruction, and kids are packing up, and they're already thinking about their social interactions that are going to come between anywhere from 2 minute passing time to 10 minute passing. When we know that's a really prime time for the brain to start thinking about what they learned that day, reflecting on it, maybe even a quick formative assessment on what's the one thing that I got out of the class today, what's the one question I have. We know from memory research that you got to start using it right away. The Ebbinghaus curve, which is this famous research, every teacher should know, because what I think somewhat depressing, but boy, it will change how you think as teachers, is kids are forgetting what you taught them immediately. So if I just teach you the Civil War started in 1861 at Fort Sumter, that pause is you're already forgetting it. Right? So, we have to be doing something, and that something can't be in a summative assessment in 2 weeks. Because then the kids are just relearning it.
That's right.
For the short term. I mean, there's things I'm looking at the list as a reminder. I should probably memorize it by now. The things that keep, you know, an unconscionable me, if I had a chance to do a volume 2 of the book or the second edition, I don't believe any high school should start before 8:30 a.m. Now, I know there's superintendents who might listen to this podcast and might freak out and say, buddy, you don't know the economics to that. And I agree. But the sleep research is just too compelling for any school to begin before 8:30 a.m. in the morning. And I understand the difficulty of that. The other new unconscionable that I would add, so I figure I want to give people fresh stuff.
Yeah, this is exclusive content for our listeners.
I'm coming out here on this.
I love it. So,
the other one, not only would I say should no high school start at 8:30 ever again, but based on research, but if you know research around cognitive load and cognitive transitions, and even homework per se, you shouldn't never have more than 4 subjects a day. I'll lean into 5. But imagine if kids only had one to prepare for 4 subjects a day. And I'm not saying these subjects should be 90-minute periods. But, you know, what if they were like 65-minute periods and the breaks were longer and there was more collaboration time and office hour time? So I'm looking at my conscious list. It has 13. I just added 2 more. Now we're at 15. We're in good shape. I will say another, in the spirit of unconscionable, I think project-based learning is really critical to teaching and learning. But I do believe we have to figure out, all teachers, what is the right amount of content knowledge every kid needs to enter a project with? And I think it's made our list. I think it was number 9-ish, because we wanted to remind people that in this number 9, that you shouldn't lecture for the whole period, but you do need content knowledge to do creative passion pursuit stuff. I think that's one thing that we would want to remind people about. And then obviously the big one, which gets all the attention, if a teacher tells me they believe in the learning style research and they teach each kid's individual learning style, I know that's the starting point. Because the learning style theory, which I know intuitively we all want to believe, right, that I learn best visually, so if you teach me visually and assess me visually, I will achieve at a higher level than if you taught me in a multiple modality instruction, has never been proven, right? So even though people have overinterpreted and incorrectly interpreted Howard Gardner's work, and he's out there trying to sell people, hey, that's not what I meant, I think learning styles fits into this idea of fixed mindset. And I think that's an area that probably we can, most teachers still believe learning style theory is true. So those are some of my unconscionables that I would prioritize when I talk to schools and when Ian and I work with schools.
Wow. There are,
does that answer the question, Ben?
Oh, okay? Absolutely. But there are like 1,000 follow-up questions we have on that. So we're probably going to spend the rest of our time on just what you said. That was amazing. So I would love to hear more about start and end of class and the brain loves novelty. You start your class in an amazing, exciting way that makes me want to be in it. So can you talk about how you start class and then why you do that?
Yeah. I mean, I think sometimes we forget kids are entering our class. They're going to give the teacher a fresh start generally every day. Look, the school year is long. It's a marathon, right? 180 days for most schools days. I think it should be longer, at least in this part of the world. We don't have many kids who are farmers who need to be on the field or in the factories. Maybe in the Midwest or out West, you guys can make that argument much better than ours. If anything, we have more beach lifeguards than anything else. But you know, I've always been intrigued. And to be honest, a very traditional way I start my classes is actually really just is selfish. I am from New Jersey. I'm a huge Bruce Springsteen fan. He's my man crush. My wife and I have joked, right? I would leave her for Springsteen. She would leave me for Sting. I don't know who gets the better deal. She might get the better deal. I hope this is for adults. I either taught eighth period or the period right after lunch. And it was, I generally think about instructional differentiation. You know, that's such a loaded term, right? You know, you should be thinking about how to teach. If you teach the same subject, first period and the period after lunch and eighth period, in some ways, all three of those have to be a little different. Kids are at a different state of mind and energy level. So I think it was after a lunch period, and I said, this is not starting well. And I think that's when I started, probably a decade ago, throwing on Bruce Springsteen, you know, the greatest musician in American history, is the opening refrain of Born to Run. You know, dun, 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 dun.
Baby, we were born to run.
Don't go public on that one, but that's okay. But, you know, and boy, you know, kids were like, whoa, okay, so we get it. Okay, so that gives a little dopamine boost. Usually I know nothing to do when we were studying, like, you know, Manifest Destiny. I don't know how I would connect Born to Run. Maybe it's the people going across country. I don't know. Yeah. But kids got fired up and they would actually complain, where is that dopamine boost? Right. Mm. And then over the years, I would add different, you know, Billy Joel's We Didn't Start the Fire would always be played during when we're studying the Cold War. They Might Be Giants has a great song about James K. Polk. You know, but there's a variety of ways you can be in class. I mean, I love the teacher who is every Monday, and she says, I can't do 5 days a week. I said, okay, what about every Monday? Every Monday, she asks her teacher kids three questions. Give me one thing you recall from last week, one thing you recall from a month ago, and let's say for this point of the year, one thing you recall from September. Just some formative, engaging assessment, right? Just to see, have kids practice with the stuff. You know, you can immediately get kids reading something, looking at a picture. While, again, you're doing attendance and administrative that we all have to do. We know it's part of our job, right? I get it. So I just would say those first few minutes of class, and I would say somewhere in that 10-minute range, the research around the primacy recency effect is good. It's not great. I think there's probably a very good study out there still to be done about it. It's fertile, ready-made research that people should be using to perform their practice. I know I went a little off tangent there, Ben, but
no,
I was having too much fun.
That's perfect.
Well,
I want to dig in a little bit more too on what you said before about labels and how we label students. And I 100%. I think everybody's nodding their heads furiously when they hear, like, yes, don't label a student lazy, don't label a student disengaged, blah, blah, blah. But I think it's sometimes a harder pitch when we ask people not to label students as visual learners or, you know, kinesthetic learners or things like that, just because it's been such a hot topic for so long. And I think even adults, we do that to ourselves a lot with, like, you know, I'm an ENFJ or whatever on Myers-Briggs. Like, what does that do to us and our students in the classroom? And why do you preach moving away from that?
Well, I mean, look, I think some of the most compelling application of research by teachers and school leaders has been in the field of mindset, right? And certainly Carol Dweck's work is fantastic. You know, and I think when our school actually began this work in this, it was interesting. Part of the training we received was around avoiding labels, especially in faculty meetings. You know, a number of schools, and rightly so, and I hope they do this, you know, get together as faculty at various points, whether it's grade level, discipline, or whole school, and talk about kid progress. And, you know, how many of those meetings do you hear, why is this kid doing poorly, or, you know, they're not motivated, they don't care. And, you know, I think that creates this fixed mindset for the adult. And I also think it creates this sort of, you know, as I said earlier, this self-fulfilling prophecy for the kid. Now, I think there's an easy solve. I mean, we all fall into that trap. We're tired, we're frustrated. I just want people to be able to respond to it. If you call a student lazy, I think you should be able to respond to a follow-up question of what's lazy look like. And it's really a simplistic way to get some descriptors and observation out there when we talk about kids. Or even a kid, you know, this is really hard for me. And, you know, what makes this hard? But in the spirit of the mindset research, I just think we got to do anything that's going to create a fixed mindset for our kids. Ways to go about it? Well, we teach them about neuroplasticity and elements of the anatomy of the brain, how the brain changes through deliberate practice. But we also really try to make sure we can describe learning better. We can base it on observations and not, you know, both implicit, explicit, you know, microaggression, any biases that we all bring to the table. I mean, a matter of fact, I'll just stretch the mindset work. Our favorite organization out there, probably in many ways right now, is the Mindset Scholars Network. They might have originated out at Stanford. It's called the Mindset Scholars Network. And what we love about their work is they've brought in this whole mindset thinking to add two other mindsets. One is called the belonging mindset, which I would actually argue is more important. The belonging mindset is probably more important than even the growth mindset. If a kid doesn't feel like he or she belongs, you're not going to get them wanting to work harder and smarter to grow. The other mindset we really like is the purpose and relevance mindset. That's really critical. I mean, I think it's sometimes, you know, not all learning kids are going to see the purpose and relevance yet, but I do believe us teachers should think about what we're teaching leading toward. So I know I've stretched that for, you know, your initial question was around labels. I just think labels become self-fulfilling prophecies. If you're self-labeling, I think if you think about a kid as one way as a learner, you don't understand the research behind neuroplasticity and what they might currently be good at. I mean, you might have a third grader who, you know, knows their maths great. That might be a current strength. That might not be the same thing in seventh grade or 12th grade. We hope it does. We hope that strength is supported by other strengths. But I think I think labels become a little concerning as fueling fixed mindsets amongst the adults and the student learner, and we should try to avoid them at all costs.
Oh, I have experienced that as both a student and then as a teacher in different places that I've been, where when I've felt that I've been labeled, I tended to act in that way, whether it was class clown or, you know, whatever that ends up being. That you're totally right that the labels are bad for the brain. So we talked
right,
about
and it's beyond academic labels, right? And we certainly know class, gender, race, you know, all that, you know. You know, there's great studies where, you know, student, you know, he or she was reminded of their race before a math assessment, whether you're white, black, green, you know, you name it. And just merely that reminder led to different results on the assessments. Mariel Hardiman out of Johns Hopkins, one of our favorite researchers in this space and one of an early mentors of both me and Ian and our center at St. Andrews, you know, talks about this concept of downshifting, which we approached in the book, where, and all of us, I bet any of your listeners could relate to this. What was that moment in your educational journey where you were downshifted, you know, something, an action or something an adult said, and that adult could be a teacher or a coach, that paralyzed you as a learner? We've all had those moments. And, you know, those we just have to avoid, especially for our students that come from some of the most at-risk situations whose journey is that much steeper and harder, but is still possible.
Yeah, I heard one of your talks where your downshifting moment was a teacher who handed back grammar tests in grade order, and you just would hope and hope and hope that you were in the top half, and you weren't. And that I totally have had so many experiences like that where I felt downshifted and shut down for the rest of a class. So I love that.
Yeah, that's a good memory. Yeah, no, that's the one I go to all the time. I mean, that is still clearly my therapist has not worked wonders on me yet. After, yeah.
Editor did, because you have no mistakes in the book, so that's a good thing.
We had good editors.
Definitely. So we talked about things you definitely shouldn't do, the unconscionable list, but what are some things that the research is showing us that we should do? Your book lists 12 things that teachers should do for every student every day. Would you speak to a few of those?
Yeah, I'm thinking about this time of year, so we're in April, and one of the things I loved in terms of changes at our school was when we started looking at the research around choice and intrinsic motivation and engagement. So we're headed into our final exam period, and you know, I've been here 20 years at St. Andrews, and you know, 20 years ago, everybody took the same type of exam, 2-hour sit down, grade 6 through 12. Regardless if that was the best way you should be assessed, or that's how the assessments were driven during the class year, that was it. One size fits all model. If you come back now in 2018, in this May, right, a number of teachers give choice final exams, which I love, right? So where is choice in your curriculum in the school year is a question I hope every teacher can be able to answer. And it doesn't have to be every time, right? There's some things kids just have to do, right? You know, it's not all medicine tastes great, right? You know, not all learning can be fun and can be choice. We have to expose kids to certain things. But choice is really something that I think most teachers can elevate during the year. And we do it. Final exams now, many of them are, kids can have a traditional sit down, which for some kids, that's perfect. I know my own history class, we have something called the Historian's TED, which leverages visual demonstration of historical content knowledge and skills and combines that with a narrative. And that's a fun one. We have a variety of things. We have kids who've made podcasts for their final exam as opposed to a 2-hour sit down. And yes, that's maybe not like that teacher's own experience, but I think it's important. And I also think it reflects, you know, how much we know about education. I think formative assessment is still an underutilized teaching pedagogical strategy and memory strategy. I actually would argue our school assesses more than ever, but in a very non-threatening, low-stakes, formative way. That data is used by both the teacher and the student to see where we are, what was learned, what was not, and merely to practice. And again, these are 5-minute moments. You know, I'm not trying to tell you to disrupt your whole learning. I think a big one for me as a teacher was, I don't think I probably until the last 5 to 7 years understood the connection between emotion and cognition. Sad students, hungry students, fearful students, I don't care how good a teacher you are not going to learn your stuff. You know, sleepless students. The great thing I ask, we were in front of about 1,000 people recently, and I said, look, you know, this is prom season. I hate prom season for so many reasons, mostly because there's always a stupid situation in a couple or a friendship or relationship. And it happened, right? I was about to give an assessment, and here comes a young woman. She's a puddle, right? She's a mess, right? And I was going to give actually a summative assessment that day, and I think I write about this in the book as well. It seems like it happens almost every year now. And I have a choice as a teacher, right? Do I make this girl take that assessment at that time? Now, the old Glenn, the Glenn of 20 years ago, would have said, it's my curriculum, it's my time, you know, suck it up. And
it's,
I'm
grit.
Like, you know, and that, yeah, okay, it's great. Yeah, fine. But I would say the odds are I really want to know what this girl or any student knows. So what's the loss if I allow her to take it tomorrow, the next day, just so they can regroup? Am I less rigorous? Well, I probably used to think I was. Mm. Am I being unfair to the kids who take it on time? I like Rick Wormley's quote that fair is not always equal.
Yeah.
I think that's a fair, that's to me, that's good. So, you know, choice, emotion, and cognition, I think, are ones I've already mentioned early on, beginning class and ending class better. I think using the better memory strategies, spacing, active retrieval, I think dual coding, explaining it to students, they get it. You know, so if they're trying to memorize something, you know, even trying to draw it out or visually represent it as well. And the other thing I think I'm finding very interesting, and I don't think I made it on our list, I was just trying to look quickly.
More exclusive content. I love
it. Know, more. Teaching kids the neuroanatomy behind learning. What's going on in the brain? What's the hippocampus and the amygdala and the limbic system and corpus callosum and the prefrontal cortex and myelination and you name it. I find as I talk to kids about that, they are making these very organic, hey, that's what by doing this might help this, is somewhat very empowering, fertile ground for us to play in as educators.
So another thing that I love about your book is how it models best practice with respect to a lot of these things. Like, you ask the reader to see, think, and wonder. You ask us to identify two things we'll do tomorrow, and, you know, ask us to come up with questions, things like that. So I want to ask you for some advice now for our podcast. How can we use concepts like that or other things that you know about learning in the brain to make this podcast more impactful for our listeners?
It's interesting because we launched our first, we have a publication called Think Differently and Deeply. So we're doing an author's podcast around it.
I just saw that. I'm going to subscribe.
So I'll share you some state secrets. If you listen to the end, we have a exit ticket on our podcast. So, you know, how can you end your podcast where, you know, after somebody's, you know, committed time to listening to this guy from New Jersey for a quick moment of reflection. I do believe with educators, where we miss is every educator brings prior knowledge, experience, and skills to all their adult learning, right? There is this moment at the beginning of a podcast. I don't know how to do it. I'll leave it to you guys to figure it out, where I would love people who, before they listen, to think about what they currently know, right? So if you guys market this as, hey, this is Glenn Whitman, one of the co-authors of NeuroTeach, and, you know, he works in the field of mind-brain education science, what five things do you already know about or do you believe about this field? And have a little moment of silence. I think it's a missed opportunity, right? You know, it's almost a formative assessment for the adult learner.
I love how you are a social studies teacher and you talk like a science teacher to me, and that is... it's challenging to me because, yeah, I think you and I could have a 3-hour talk about Sherman's March to the Sea because I taught social studies also, but I couldn't hang with you at all on the brain stuff, and I want to get better at that because it is so crucial, and I just love that. So,
yeah, well, you know, look, I think, and I've said this before, I say this a lot, actually, you know, I'm an exponentially better, I still teach a class, so I'm an exponentially better teacher today than I was clearly when I started in 1991, but I would even argue better than September. The challenge I will throw out to those listeners, you know, teaching is a learning profession for the adult, right? You know, I've been fortunate to be at 3 schools. This is my 3rd school. And I just want to go on record. I've never been fired from any. I just want to go clear there. And I really have come to the conclusion that the best way to sometimes teach our students is to model ourselves as learners. And I would argue you should be better in June than you were in September, if that's your school year. And I would say, look, every year during the run of the school year, I am privileged to hear from somebody or learn from somebody something that I can try in my classroom that's different. Whether, you know, I'm a big fan of Project Zero and the thinking routines, and maybe Ron Richard, I think is his name. You know, I think I read something in the last 3 or 4 months. It was a new thinking routine that I could put in my class. We owe that to our students. And I would actually say we owe it to ourselves. That's what teachers were in a battle profession. We're never going to get paid what we deserve, unfortunately. But boy, we can have more fun and enjoy it as learners. And I would say, if you can't say you're better in June and you're doing something differently in June than in September, to be honest, I'm not too sure if it was a great professional growth year for you. And look, if the CTTL can help you guys do that, people out there do that, that's excellent. But that should be the goal we strive for, because it's the same goal we have for our kids. So I hope nobody unplugs me at this point for being controversial, but I think it's within all our reach.
Totally.
I think that's 100% true. We really do focus a lot on continuous improvement and professional learning, but how do you have some practical places we can go to learn more about these kinds of things? Like, Ben, I think that's what you were getting at, Ben, I'm not sure, but if I want to pursue there's master's certificates and doctoral pathways you can do now in mind-brain education, but I don't have the money for that or the time right now. So where are some places that we can go to learn more about this or get better at this?
So I'll announce something that's pretty exciting for your audience shortly. So I think Twitter has been a great lifeline in this space, mostly because I think that I've been exposed to the learning scientists, which I don't know if people know. The learning scientists have some of the best podcasts that are really great for teachers and students. If every teacher's not subscribing to them, then go for it. I think there are, in a shameless plug, if you follow me, G. Whitman, CTTL, or the CTTL, we have a lot of links to our favorite friends. The other thing I will say, this might be premature, but what the hell? Nobody's going to kill me about it. You know, you bring up an interesting problem, right? How do you grow in this space, right? How do you go from a novice understanding of mind, brain, education, science to a teacher leader level? Not only that, how do you leverage technology to do that? How do you avoid it costing $14,000 to get a certificate or a master's degree or a PhD in this field? So the cool thing is we have something for you. In January of 2019, and this, I think this might be the official launch now, we are launching
this is
something
awesome.
Called... Yeah, this is big. So you guys better pump this thing out there.
Oh, we will pump it.
Oh, we will.
So in January of 2019, we are launching what is called NeuroTeach Global, which is pretty cool. We've been piloting it with certain school districts. And what it is through a digital device of a teacher's choosing, you will get these 5 to 7 minute mind, brain, and education science micro-learning experiences. It's a three-level program, but we hope teachers will jump into this because one, we want to see if we have something here. We had a local teacher, she did one of the 7 minute experiences while she was making toast for her children. Now, is that good PD? Well, we're going to study it. We know there's a hunger by teachers to want to serve their kids really well. Generally, all teachers love their students and are frustrated that they can't do more for them. We would argue the more they know about the learning brain, the better they will be able to do their jobs and actually enjoy their jobs. We know most PD, professional development, for most teachers around the country is actually doesn't lead to behavior change and change in practice.
Mm-hmm.
So figure out what you need at this point in your education journey, your teaching journey. And if we can help in any way, hopefully people know where to find us.
Can I ask you, one of the things I loved in one of your talks was the research behind multitasking, and it changed how I did things this week. And I think it made a huge difference. So can you talk to us about what science is saying about multitasking?
Yeah, I mean, look, the science is pretty strong that the brain cannot multitask two cognitive demands at the same time. So you can breathe and read. Unfortunately, too much of education is about multitasking, right? We do this fun activity. Obviously, maybe Ben, you remember when we're in person where we have people not multitask and then try to do something multitasking, and then obviously it slows them down. We certainly know when in the old days when you were lost, you know, when Springsteen was jamming on the radio, but you got lost in the middle of Colorado, the first thing you did was turn off the radio, right? Now the first thing I probably do is, I guess, ask Siri. Knowing the research behind multitasking, I think it really means that teachers should really think both the pace and the speed and the amount of information and tasks they're giving students. You know, so too many times we've been to classes, take out your book, take out a pencil, open up to page 30 and start writing. Well, there's four directions and most kids are still trying to figure out what did you say first.
Mm-hmm.
So even just pausing, okay, take out your book. All right, turn to page 68. Do you have a writing instrument? Okay, here's what we're trying to accomplish. I think that's, you know, I think some of the pacing and flow, and it's why we've gone after, you know, we've tried to reduce the cognitive load of our kids because, right, multitasking is really hard. Most people think they are good multitaskers. Research actually shows that people who identify as good multitasking are actually lousy at multitasking.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Yeah.
So I think multitasking is really an easy thing for teachers to go after. Right, we know the brain, every kid's brain processes differently. So just being a little more methodical and slow and step and sort of checklist oriented to me is a helpful adjustment I've made in my own teaching that acknowledges that multitasking is a real challenge for most kids and for most adults, even though we think we can do it. But if you are multitasking, you're really probably, it's surface learning at best.
Mm-hmm.
It's not deep learning.
Mm-hmm. What's one habit or memory strategy that you have learned recently that you use all the time for your own professional learning that we can learn from?
Self-testing to me is the million-dollar strategy. You know, I tell my students before any study session at home, pull out a blank white piece of paper, think about what the topic is you're trying to study for, and see how much you can recall without looking at anything. And then build upon that those gaps. So I would say those memory strategies have been really critical, have been an adjustment in how I've approached as an adult learner and trying to prioritize other strategies for my students.
Hmm.
I remember distinctly when we were writing, we were in the early pages of writing the book, neuroteach, and I self-diagnosed I had a hernia, and I was driving down to Dr. Cullen's office on Wisconsin Avenue in Bethesda, Maryland, and maybe my brain wanders, and I sort of was playing out the scenario of what if I went into Dr. Cullen and I said, Doc, I think I have a hernia. I think I was writing the chapters on I Love Your Amygdalas, actually, mm-hmm. the chapter. I remember I was writing that. And, I play out the scenario like, okay, so let's say Dr. Cullen, who I've known for a long time, say, hey, Glenn, I love your hernia. I care deeply about your hernia. And on some level, I want my doctor to have that emotional connection, both to me, but also to, I guess, one of my body parts, right? But then, as I was thinking about it, as I was laughing myself, if I asked Dr. Cullen, Doc, have you ever studied the hernia? And, Dr. Cullen said, no. My next decision ultimately is get the hell out of there, right?
Yep.
I wouldn't want anybody to cut into my gut to do that. And that's the same scenario our kids walk into schools with, right? If they're walking into classrooms and schools where the teachers and school leaders have never studied the organ of learning. How to teach a prep programs, how to teach a PD programs, whether in universities or a teacher's home school, prioritize some foundational knowledge in the learning brain. Would it be called educational malpractice? That sure is we debate. But certainly if Dr. Cullen cut into my hernia without studying it, I would sue him.
Yeah.
Right? Now, I'm not encouraging students, if you're listening, I do not encourage you to sue your school districts. But the analogy is not as far off as I think I thought about it the first time I was driving to his office. And if we can close that gap, and the good news is there's a lot of good research out there that's ready to go. Teachers need, the right culture, the morale, and the time to do it. If we're not prioritizing learning brain and learning sciences in our educational growth plans at our schools, then what are we prioritizing? Because what happens is knowing that research will validate how do you do project-based learning better, multicultural education better, culturally responsive teaching better. I think it gets you to do those other initiatives better because there's more convincing research behind them.
It's like the foundation for everything else.
Yeah.
It has to be. It should be. That's amazing.
Yeah. No, I think I would say it's a no-brainer, but boy, that gets corny.
We just love puns around here, Glenn.
We like brains. Yeah, brain. The brain. The no-brainer.
So Ben, I got you that story in. I hope
that's amazing.
Perfect.
I don't know if it's the end of the podcast or not, but one of my final messages to you is you can do what we have done at St. Andrews. You can dedicate a portion of your time and training of your faculty to making them expert in the learning brain without threatening their content knowledge or making it seem like more work. But you also can do it within partnerships with universities that might be right on your doorstep. Or if you're in the more rural areas, all you need is a Zoom account. I think there's a growing interest of researchers at universities that want their stuff to matter more.
Mm-hmm.
And they just need allies in our school settings, whether it's preschool through 12th grade, you name it, who want to play together. So I hope anybody who's listening wants us to be allies and friends. We're all in with you. Let's keep playing.
Yeah, let's do
it.
Thank you, Glenn. Well, I know I say this a lot, and I do have a tendency to speak in hyperbole, but that was probably the best interview of all time.
It totally was. I learned so much about the importance of being aware of neuroscientific research and just how much it can actually help us all be better teachers, and I can't wait to hop into NeuroTeach Global in January.
Yeah, me too. Dibs on you as a study partner, okay? We'll do it together. I can't wait to dig into more of this with my professional learning network. I've always been fascinated by brain development and the amazing processes that are happening just underneath our skulls, and I'm always motivated by the fact that teachers are, in fact, in the very literal sense of the word, brain changers. The students' brains look and function differently and make different connections when they come away from your class every day. So how much of an impact do we actually have on their brains is up to us. And I'm so excited that there's a cohort of teachers in our district now that are reading about this research and incorporating it into their instruction.
Yeah, for sure. There was so much important content in this episode. I loved editing it because it was great for me to hear it 10, 15 times and keep learning more. There's this whole burgeoning field out there on mind-brain education, and there's so much to just keep learning, and this is just the tip of the iceberg. So make sure you check out the show notes where we link to all the research and things that he talked about, where you can just swipe up on your iPhone or iPad, or you can hit that up on brainwaves.com, and the links are all there. Also, Becky and I are super excited that starting next episode, we're going to take all of Glenn's really ideas about how to start a podcast based on brain research to heart. And so we are going to start that next week. We're looking forward to it. Thanks so much for listening, and have a great generic time of day.